Hi, y'all. Welcome to our first podcast. This is Escadar.
I'm Athena.
And this is Eve.
So today in our first podcast, we're going to be focusing on whiteness and white supremacy in the founding of medicine, whiteness and white supremacy in contemporary medicine, and lastly, medical discrimination. For our housekeeping purposes, we're going to talk about some terms that we're going to be discussing a lot throughout this podcast and future podcasts. So we're going to focus on words such as equality, whiteness, white supremacy, and also understanding whiteness as property. And so what is equality, for example? Equality is typically defined as treating everyone the same and giving everyone access to the same opportunities, whereas equity refers to proportional representation by whether it's race, class, gender, sexuality, preference, in that same opportunities.
So I think another really important thing to note when discussing equality versus equity is to also incorporate the word justice and actually utilizing those terminologies and ensuring that you're actually giving people the things that are needed. It's not just necessarily about making sure that everyone's equal, but that everyone is equal in a just environment.
So understanding the difference between equality and equity is very critical and foundational to a lot of the work that we're going to be doing. The next term is white supremacy. And so white supremacy really talks about the belief that white people are superior in the creation of structures, systems, and societal norms that therefore uphold this constructed superiority of whiteness. And so what is whiteness? Well, whiteness is a socially constructed normalization and censoring of white racial identity, less so to do with appearance and more about power and property. Whiteness is an ownership of the systems within which you exist and the ability to decide who can gain access to those systems. Think about whiteness as an ideology that derives from the historical practice of institutionalizing white supremacy.
And so in addition to kind of what we've already said about whiteness, something that Cheryl Harris writes in Whiteness as Property is the line that essentially whiteness and property share the common premise that they have the right to exclude. And so whiteness is more so in its practice about the ability to control the environment that you're within and control who has a right and access to different systems, different physical pieces of property and institutions and things like that. And so in the case of white supremacy, that often comes with the enacting of whiteness. You have this system in which white people get to decide who gains access to what institutions and more importantly, what systems those institutions are built upon. And in the context of our podcast, we have a health system here in the United States, which was built upon white supremacy. And so often whiteness still plays out in the ways that Black people and other minoritized populations are able to have access to those systems. And then on top of that, what that access actually looks like once they're able to get their foot in the door.
And we want to make sure we talk about these concepts because you can't really have health equity without delving into the history of anti-Blackness and how anti-Blackness was created through white supremacy, colonization, and all of these factors. And so just talking about social determinants of health or structural violence without centering white supremacy is not only futile, but violent towards Black communities and their health outcomes.
And so I feel like when you talk about how whiteness and white supremacy has affected our health system, it really goes all the way back until slave period. And so you're thinking about these different like medical justifications for defending slavery. So conditions like drapetomania, which they would give to runaway slaves, and this idea that, you know, abolition and wanting to be able to end slavery with some sort of medical condition that they could explain away. And even thinking about experimentation on Black folks within slavery, thinking about gynecology, which is a really popular example, and how you had these slave hospitals where they were literally just kind of taking women and doing whatever they wanted to with their bodies and then using those different modes of exploitation to better the health of white women while simultaneously harming and maiming all of these Black women who were enslaved.
Right, and that experimentation we can see today among Black women and the mortality that they face in access to healthcare, how physicians think that Black women and Black people generally have higher tolerance to pain because they would experiment on Black people who were enslaved without any anesthesia and justified it as Black people are more subhuman or closer to animals, thus they don't feel that much pain. And we see that to this day. So it's definitely not just a historicalized aspect of our healthcare system.
Yeah. And there was this study in 2016 out of the University of Virginia, where they actually found like exactly that. And they found that it was a statistically like significant number of white medical students and residents who actually thought that their Black patients were biologically different from their white patients. And they thought that Black people had thicker skin, that they had less nerve endings, and that they had blood that coagulated more quickly than whites. And when you look more deeply into the data, you see that this affects a lot of different surgical outcomes, birthing outcomes, diagnoses, and things like that, that are all really detrimental to our health.
Exactly. And so we know all these facts, right, that the XYZ things have happened, but how has that manifested in a way or in a form that where we ourselves are like, or anybody aspiring or the current medical professionals are perpetuating this harm of anti-Blackness towards Black folk? A lot of this stuff has manifested in ways where there are anti-Black policies and practices that contribute to housing education inequities or food apartheid or low insurance and underinsurance rates or chronic stress from facing racism, misogyny in everyday settings, even police brutality, which all contribute to Black people's health outcomes. And so with all those things in mind, a little side note, when we talk to our patients, we should be considering all these extra factors that are occurring in this Black person's everyday lives before we make any assumptions or think of anything that might further perpetuate anti-Blackness, which all further harms Black people in a negative way. So with all these things in mind, we need to really understand that healthcare doesn't happen in a silo. So we should always be questioning ourselves. And one question we should think about right now is, how can we have an equitable healthcare in a white supremacist colonial settler state that in every way perpetuates violence against Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities?
So I think something that's really like important to consider about this question is, what does it mean to be in a settler colonial state? And the idea of being on stolen land and what it means to enact justice in, you know, something that isn't ours. And I feel like a lot of times when we talk about stolen land and living in a settler colonial state and things like that, stolen land is considered some sort of metaphor, but it's not. You know, white settlers literally came here and they kicked Native peoples off of their land. They murdered them. They ostracized them. They destroyed their cultures. They sent them to these American boarding schools and all these different forms of violence that are often really just ignored today. And we often don't think about how those play into these systems that we are then kind of functioning within. And so you see these really, really disparate health outcomes in Black folks, but as well as in Indigenous folks. And a lot of times those health outcomes for Indigenous folks aren't even spoken about, but it's kind of, you know, it's the struggle that exists. And so when you think about then enacting justice in this kind of really, really messed up system, to put it very plainly. And so a lot of people are like, oh, well, how do we fix the system and how do we make it so that it can work? And the fact is that it can't, because you can't enact justice in a system that is innately unjust. Like, the two just don't mix. It's like oil and water. And so when you're thinking about the ways that we can enact like radical care and that we can, you know, fix these health disparities and that, you know, we can integrate all of these different things, that also comes with abolishing kind of the concept of the U.S., abolishing the system that we know to be existing. And so within that, you have to think about kind of the bigger picture. And obviously, you know, that's hard for some people. It's the way we live, but it's necessary. I think for me, one of the biggest things with, you know, radical care and revolutionizing healthcare is that we have to dismantle the systems that it exists within. And that includes dismantling the white supremacist state.
And when thinking about how do we actually do this work, I think it's really important to think about knowledge production in medicine and healthcare and public health and who are leading these conversations. Because oftentimes it's not community organizers that have radical thoughts about abolition and health justice and racial justice. It's usually professors and academics and people that are deemed as educationally fit. And so I think we also have to restructure, like, whose voices do we value and what platforms are being taught to like medical students and grad students, and how we're actually incorporating these radical voices into our practices. And that really starts with uplifting voices and also institutionalizing those voices to actually bring about this dismantling that needs to occur.
Exactly. And racial literacy shouldn't be distinct to like a professor or somebody who focuses on racial literacy. Everybody should be racially literate, especially medical professionals who depend on the literal patient's feedback, like their words. And so if you are not being receptive to their words or the things they're saying, and you're not uplifting such words and their feelings, then how can you care for them?
Yeah. And I think that also kind of going back to what Escobar was saying as well, factors in, like, what do we even consider to be data? What do we consider worthy of even going into knowledge production? And I think a lot of times when we think about, like, discourse in public health, we think of medical journals and we think of clinical trials and things like that. But first of all, medical journals been racist. We knew that. So the question is, like, why are we still relying on these forms of publications and of knowledge that we know aren't doing what we think they're doing? And we have, you know, medical textbooks even are telling students that Black patients are biologically different, which time and time again has been disproven. And so that just raises the question of, like, where are we getting our data from, and why, even when we know that it's not accurate and when we know that science isn't the, like, value neutral field that a lot of people pose it to be, why is that what we're relying on instead of what Eve said? Like, why aren't we listening to the patients? Why isn't their lived experiences with their health and their interactions with healthcare enough for medical professionals to then say, okay, these are the changes that we're going to implement because we've seen that these things are happening. We've listened to you saying these things are happening and we need to do something about it, instead of reading the newest Nature article about some gene that they think Black people might have, but that they don't have any proof about.
Right. And touching on that racial biology aspect, Lashira Nolan highlighted how in medical education, like, medical students rarely see Black dummies to practice CPR on. Like, how is that socialization of whiteness contributing to what physicians deem as the norm? Or seeing dermatology pictures of diseases only on white skin, like, how is that contributing to how physicians treat Black patients or misdiagnose or underdiagnose them, and then leading to even worse health outcomes? So in addition to lack of representation in medical education, we see this perpetuated in clinical trials also, which have adverse health outcomes, because we don't know how Black, Indigenous, and Brown communities are actually affected by the trials that are only tested on white patients. So one current example is how the current COVID-19 trials have insane lack of representation of Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, yet there is talk on criminalizing individuals who do not take these vaccines. There's already a lack of trust in medicine of these minoritized communities. That, on top of the fact that these communities often cannot take time off from work, are not compensated for their time, and other structural issues that prevent them from accessing these trials, and also a lack of outreach on behalf of medical practitioners to actually build some sort of trust and rapport with communities that are underrepresented. Really, it goes back to what Athena and Eve were saying in the beginning, like, how can we have justice in such a structurally inept system? We simply can't without paying attention to these issues.
Yeah, and I think something further to consider is that we've been talking about kind of how white supremacy is more so embedded within our healthcare system and the things that are lacking within its structure. But even if we were to imagine a perfect world, where suddenly that aspect didn't exist, and so our structures were equitable, so to speak. Beyond even just the structural violence that the healthcare system often inflicts, you also have implicit bias, which also often helps to perpetuate these different systems and disparities. And this is something that Dana Bowen Matthews talks about a lot in her book, Just Medicine, and how implicit bias is kind of this constant in medicine. It persists even beyond, you know, active corrections by medical professionals, and refers to more that, so this unconscious racism. And so she lists a lot of different examples and studies in her book, which is also linked on our page, so you can check it out. But some of the things that she talks about is, you know, even not offering a more expensive treatment to a Black patient because the doctor assumes that they are low income, or assuming that a Latinx patient doesn't speak good English, and so not necessarily explaining all of their treatment options because you think they might not understand, or even something as simple as sitting across the room from your Black patient versus standing next to a white patient and making eye contact have all been things that are shown to have an effect on health disparities.
Yeah, and when thinking about how did we get here, I think it's important to recognize that American medicine, not just American society, was founded on principles of white supremacy. And we see that with the American Medical Association and how in their founding, everything was segregationist: hospitals, residency programs, medical schools. And even today, we see, like, we only have 2% of Black women doctors.
Yeah. And so going with that, what are those long-lasting effects? We see that one of the major things is, where are hospitals even located? So this touches on access. So how do you get access to healthcare if it's nowhere near you? And so in many places, like, for example, like Memphis, Tennessee, which has like a high population of Black folks, specifically low-income Black folks, that you see that there are more like hospitals in the more richer, white, affluent areas, whereas in the Blacker areas, it's sparse, right? And if there, or there'll just be like one huge hospital that everybody has to go to. And so that you see the lack of like variety of medical professionals there are in that area. And so therefore the lack of access to different forms of healthcare, whether it's that's like going to a general physician, to even seeing a chiropractor, that even that dynamic within itself is kind of shows the community of Black people that healthcare is not for them. No one's looking to make healthcare more accessible to them, even though healthcare has been the most inaccessible towards Black people.
Kind of with that, you have like this absence of hospitals and of medical facilities with the presence of all of these really, really damaging other factors. So you have, you know, pollution from factories. I recently watched a TED talk that I can't remember the name of, but I'll link it somewhere, that talks about like factory farming and how a lot of factory farms in North Carolina specifically are placed in Black low-income neighborhoods, and that they've done studies and there is a literal biological response throughout the time of days based on the methane production from the pigs that they're raising and the like blood pressure of the people living in that area. So you have all this pollution that's happening in those communities. You have typically more liquor stores, more fast food chains, fewer grocery stores, less access to fresh foods and vegetables, less gyms and public parks that are usable, you know, less like community spaces that you can exercise outside and things like that. And so it's both this lack of care as well as the presence of all of these things that are damaging towards your health. And I think that relates to, you know, something that we've talked about already, which is that we focus so much on health and medicine when we think about healthcare that we forget often to focus on the person's lived experience and the community that they're living in and all these other factors that are affecting their care, and kind of forgetting that we need to remedy all these other issues before we can really see any lasting effects in health.
Also, we can see what Athena and Eve were talking about in terms of COVID-19 as well. Though, like, Black communities have had higher rates of COVID-19 cases, they still face lower access to testing sites and treatment facilities. So, again, you have all these compounding factors that lead to disease, such as Black people being overrepresented in frontline worker jobs, lack of access to healthcare, but you don't have testing facilities. We know why this is happening, and it really requires, again, the dismantling of these violent systems.
Yeah. And the in 2003, the Unequal Treatment Report was released, and this was considered to be the first comprehensive and systemic proof that health disparities are associated with unequal care rather than biology. And 2003 is kind of late, because any Black or an Indigenous person would have told you this generations ago, which again goes back to our ideas of like what is knowledge production, etc., etc. You know, even with the COVID trials, it's like people are looking to find a reason within Black folks themselves as to why they're suffering more, and it goes along with this idea of like placing blame on the hurting population instead of on the system, and placing blame on the individual and saying, oh well, there must be something wrong with Black people if their numbers are so high, when really, like Escadar said, it goes back to the industries that they're more likely to work on, the fact that, you know, they're more likely to use public transportation and things like that, and that they still don't have access to testing or care or anything like that.
And so, yeah, so speaking about like COVID testing and where people getting access to such, it was literally said in a news article in Nashville, there were 3 drive-through testing centers that had to sit empty for weeks because the city couldn't acquire the necessary testing equipment and protective gear like gloves and masks and things like that. And it's funny because all of these were in diverse neighborhoods, one of which was the campus of Meharry Medical College, a literal historical Black institution. It's interesting that most of the testing in the Nashville region took place in walk-in clinics that are managed by like Vanderbilt University Medical Center, and those happen to be all located in white areas, such as like Belmaid, I think it's pronounced, in Brentwood, Tennessee. With that being said, it's interesting that they weren't having medical centers for where Black communities and other low-income people of color communities are located. And in addition, they weren't giving the tools to even conduct the tests, and specifically at hospitals that serve these communities that really need these tests. To add to that, in Memphis, Tennessee, also, which I, like I said, was the majority minority city, if you want to call it that, but it's a majority Black city, there was a heat map that showed where coronavirus was taking place, and it revealed that most of the screening was happening in predominantly white and well-off suburbs and not in the majority Black low-income neighborhood. Most of the city population is Black, so why is there testing only in these small pockets of white areas? It is beyond a coincidence. Because I remember reading this article a few months ago, and I was rattled. I was like, what the fuck? There's no test in the Black areas? The whole place is Black.
And reminds me that there's literally only 4 HBCU med schools, which is also wild.
I literally remember when they said Meharry didn't get any medical, like, tests or anything. I was like, yo, wow. They want Black people to die.
Damn, I think that really just underscores how important what we talked about in the beginning of this podcast relating to white supremacy and whiteness is. I think it's super crucial for listeners to understand that whiteness is not a value-neutral term. Like Eve and Athena explained in the beginning, whiteness manifests in our society as ownership and dictates what and who our systems value. The enactment of those values through white supremacy leads to exactly what Eve is describing, with a whole HBCU not being funded to do the work that it is there to do, while a PWI medical center does not face those same problems. We as aspiring healthcare providers have to enter these systems ready to challenge and dismantle them.
The lack thereof literally directly correlates with perpetuating anti-Blackness, right? I don't know. I want people to understand that this is real, because I feel like a lot of times people don't think this shit is, like, I feel like they actually think it's abstract, you know, when you read
this isn't research papers. This isn't theory.
Yeah, dead ass.
This is real. Yeah.
A lot of people don't really think about this beyond theory, because pre-health students are socialized to think about biology and chemistry, etc. But these ideas and realities often have more impact on communities' health outcomes than the actual science itself. So if you don't think about this and, like, translate your political education into action, you are contributing to disparate health outcomes.
We might be talking and you might be thinking that these are, like, cool ideas or, like, you're learning something new. But the most important part about this podcast is the after. You can sit and listen to these, but if you don't do anything with them, then there was no point in listening.
Exactly. And just really understanding that this is not just something abstract. This is really real. And that's why it's important for you all to hear us, especially, like, this is a group of 3 Black women. Like, we are the data that you are reading in your research papers. Sometimes research papers are cool, but, like, really hearing people, listening to them, especially Black folks, especially Black women, Black trans women, is really critical.
Yeah, Eve, that is so important. Listening is definitely the first step, but it cannot be the last. We want to leave y'all with some action steps we hope you'll take to engage more deeply with these central issues of racial justice and health equity, and translate what you learned from this podcast into direct action.
Okay, what could be 3 action steps be?
Something I would vote for. There's, like, a website called JLATM where you can directly donate to prisoners' commissary accounts. And as we know, the COVID pandemic is wreaking havoc in our overpopulated prison system. And so I think it would be lovely if people who have the ability were to donate funds to incarcerated folks during the pandemic and for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, especially because we know incarceration is a highly racialized system. Something I would add is, like, getting plugged into local radical Black community organizations and, like, plugging into their agendas, what they're doing for the community, how you can either donate monetarily or donate your time, and just expand your understanding of radical Black ideology and the praxis of it as well. Because I think, like we mentioned, the people on the ground doing this work are the people that need to be at the forefront of these conversations, not just in the specific areas that they're focusing on, but also how can we translate things like abolition of the prison industrial complex into our health praxis.
Exactly. It's really important to, you know, join these organizations and donate to these things, but actually understand, like, what are you doing with that, you know? And what cause are you supporting, and how can you take that information and what you've learned from such into the medical space to actually create impactful change. Because if you're just doing that on the side and not actually implementing any form of change within your medical institution, then this was all useless, you know? And lastly, it would behoove you all to really go and either search up and like listen or read about Serena Williams' birthing experience with her daughter Olympia, where she was not given equitable care and almost risked the life of her daughter. And the only reason she survived that was due to her own self-advocacy and the fact that she was not extremely knowledgeable about how her body functions, which most people don't really know all that stuff. And so take a look at her story. It's a short read, and this is the first step to listening and understanding Black women.
So thank you guys so much for tuning in. We hope that you were able to learn something from this podcast and that you will critically engage with the three different action steps we gave y'all. You can learn more about this topic discussed, as well as gain access to any of the readings or studies that we cited on our website, donoharmhrk.wordpress.com. We have a full resources page. This episode serves as kind of a foundational episode to get you guys acquainted with a lot of different topics that we're going to be kind of covering throughout the rest of our podcast series. And we hope that you guys will join us for our next episode, which will be focusing on maternal and infant mortality, as well as radical Black doula care. Thanks.
Bye, all.
Bye.